Isabella rolled up the windows and locked both doors of the Mini before she took the envelope out of her bag and held it in her lap. The address was typed, Mrs. Rose Cohen, and the Queen's Head postage stamps had been franked at Trafalgar Square Post Office. She turned the envelope over, reluctant to open it, terrified of what it might contain. There was no return address on the reverse. Still delaying the moment, she searched for the gold lady's penknife in her bag and carefully slit the flap of the envelope with its razor-edged blade. A coloured photograph slid out, and every nerve in her body tingled as she turned it face up and recognised her son. Nicky sat on a blue blanket on a garden lawn. He wore only a napkin. He was sitting up unsupported, and she reminded herself that he was nearly 7 months old. He had grown. His cheeks were not so chubby, his limbs longer and sleeker. His hair was thicker and longer, curling darkly onto his forehead. His expression was quizzical, but there was a smile hovering at the corners of his mouth, and his eyes were bright and green as emeralds. "Oh, God! He's more beautiful," she gasped, holding the photograph up to the light to study every tiny detail of his face. "He's grown so big already, and sitting up on his own, my clever little mannequin." She touched the image, and then saw with consternation that she had left a fingerprint on the glossy surface of the photograph. She wiped it off carefully with a Kleenex. "My baby," she whispered, and felt her loss tear at her heart with renewed ferocity. "Oh, my baby." The sun had sunk to touch the line of the horizon far out on the Atlantic before she could rouse herself. Only then, as she returned the photograph to the envelope, did she realise that she had overlooked the other items it contained. First, there was a photostat copy of a page from what was obviously a medical register at some child's clinic. But the name and address of the clinic had been obliterated. It was written in Spanish. His name was at the head of the sheet. Nicholas Miguel Ramon de Machado, followed by his date of birth and a record of weekly visits to the clinic. Each dated entry was in a variety of handwritings and signed by the clinic's doctors or sisters. It showed his weight and diet and dental records. She saw that on the 15th of July he had been treated for a rash that the doctor diagnosed as prickly heat, and 2 weeks later for a mild oral thrush. Otherwise he was healthy and normal. With a rush of maternal pride, she read that his first two teeth had erupted at 4 months, and he weighed almost 16 kilos. Isabella turned to the last folded sheet of paper that the envelope contained and immediately recognised the handwriting. It was in Spanish, in Adra's firm, restrained hand. "Señorita Bella, Nicky grows every day stronger and cleverer. He has a temper like one of the bulls of the corrida. He can crawl on hands and knees almost as fast as I can run, and I expect that any day now he will rise up on his back legs and walk. The first word he spoke was Mama, and I tell him each day how beautiful you are and how one day you will come to him. He does not yet understand, but one day he will. I think of you often, Señorita. You must believe that I will care for Nicky with my own life. Please do not do anything to endanger him. Respectfully, Adra Olivares." The warning contained in the last line twisted like a knife between her ribs, and was more urgent and poignant for being so mildly expressed. She knew then that she could never risk telling anyone, nor Pater, or Nana, or even Michael. She hesitated now with her hand on the handle of her bedroom door. "I have to lie to you, Mickey, I'm sorry. Perhaps one day I'll tell you the truth." She listened for a moment, but the great house was silent, and she turned the handle and quietly swung the door open. The long gallery was deserted, with only the night lights burning in their brackets on the wooden panelled walls. On bare feet, Isabella slipped silently over the Persian carpets scattered on the parquet floor. Since he was so seldom at Feltafrieden, Michael kept his old room in the nursery wing. He was sitting up in bed reading. As soon as she pushed the door open, he dropped the book on the bedside table and lifted the bedclothes for her. As she climbed in beside him, he tucked the eiderdown around her shoulders, and she clung to him, shivering with misery. They held each other for a long time in silence before Michael invited her gently. "Tell me, Bella." Even then she could not say it immediately. Her good intentions wavered. She felt the desperate temptation to ignore Adra's warning. Mickey was the only one of the family who knew that Ramon and Nicky even existed. She wanted desperately to blurt it all out to him, and have his gentle, warming comfort to help fill the terrible void in her soul. Then the image of Nicky that she had watched on the video film flashed before her eyes once more. She drew a deep breath and pressed her face to Michael's chest. "Nicky is dead," she whispered, and felt him flinch in her embrace. He did not reply at once. "It's true," she consoled herself silently. "Nicky is dead to all of us now." And yet the words seemed a dreadful betrayal of Michael and of Nicky. She did not, dare not, trust him. She had denied the existence of her own son to him, and the falsehood seemed to increase her own misery and isolation, if that were possible. "How?" Michael asked at last, and she had anticipated the question. "Cot death," she whispered. "I went to wake him for his feed, and he was cold and dead." She felt Michael shiver against her. "Oh, God! My poor Bella! How horrible, how cruel!" The reality was crueler and even more horrible than he could imagine, but she could not share it with him. After a long minute he asked, "Ramon? Where is Ramon? He should be here to comfort you." "Ramon," she repeated the name, trying to keep fear out of her voice. "When Nicky was gone, Ramon changed completely. I think he blamed me. His love for me died with Nicky." She found herself weeping now, hard, tearing sobs that expressed all the grief and terror and loneliness that had haunted her for so long. "Nicky is gone. Ramon is gone. I will never see either of them again, not as long as I live." Michael hugged her tightly. His body was hard and warm and strong. Masculine strength that was completely devoid of sexuality was what she needed most. She felt it flowing into her like water, filling the depleted dam of her courage and fortitude, and she clung to him silently. After a while he began to talk. She lay and listened, her ear pressed to his chest, so that his voice was a reverberating murmur. He talked of love and suffering, of loneliness and of hope, and at last, of death. "The true terror of death is its finality, the ending so abrupt, the void beyond so irrevocable. You cannot challenge death or appeal against it. You only break your heart if you try." Platitudes, she thought. Old clichés, the same ones with which man has tried to console himself for tens of thousands of years. Yet, like most clichés, they were true, and they were the only comfort that she had available to her. More important than the sense of the words was the soft lulling music of Michael's voice, the warmth and strength of his body, and his love for her. At last she fell asleep. She awoke before dawn and was immediately aware that he had lain all night without moving so as not to disturb her, and that he was awake also. "Thank you, Mickey," she whispered. "You'll never know how alone I have been. I needed that badly." "I do know, Bella. I know what loneliness is." And she felt her heart go out to him, her own pain temporarily assuaged. She wanted to be there for him now. It was his turn. "Tell me about your new book, Mickey. I haven't read it yet, I'm sorry." He had sent her a pre-publication copy, lovingly inscribed, but she had been totally engrossed with her own suffering. There had been no time for anybody else, not even Mickey. So this time, while she listened, he talked about the book, and then about himself and his view of the world around them. "I have spoken to Rali Tabaka again," he said suddenly, and she was startled. She had not thought of that name since she left London. "Where? Where did you meet him?" Michael shook his head. "I did not meet him. We spoke on the telephone very briefly. I think he was calling from another country. But he will be here soon. He is a will-o'-the-wisp, a black pimpernel. He comes and goes across borders like a shadow." "You have arranged to meet him?" she asked. "Yes, he's as good as his word." "Be careful, Mickey. Please promise me you'll be careful. He's a dangerous man." "Oh, there is nothing for you to worry about," he assured her. "I'm no hero. I'm not like Sean or Gary. I'll be careful. Very careful, I promise you. Michael Courtney parked his battered Valiant in the car park of a drive-in restaurant on an off-ramp of the main Johannesburg to Durban highway. He switched off the ignition, but the engine continued running on pre-ignition for a few unsteady beats. It had been missing badly all the way down from the offices of the Golden City Mail in central Johannesburg. The car had clocked up over 70,000 miles and should have been sold 2 years previously. As deputy editor, his contract stipulated that he was entitled to a new luxury vehicle every 12 months. However, Michael had developed an affection for the old Valiant. All its scars and scrapes had been honourably acquired, while over the years the driver's seat had taken on the contours of his body. He studied the other vehicles in the car park, but none of them answered the description he had been given. He glanced at his wristwatch, a Japanese digital for which he had paid $5 on a trip to Tokyo for the newspaper the previous year. He was 20 minutes early at the rendezvous, so he lit a cigarette and slumped down in the comfortable, shabby old seat. Thinking about the car and the watch made him smile. He really was the odd man out in his family. From Nana down to Bella, they were all obsessed with material possessions. Nana had her daffodil-coloured Daimlers. The colour was always the same, although the model changed each year. Pater kept a garage filled with classic cars, mostly British sports cars like the SS Jaguar and the big 6-litre touring Bentley in racing green. Gary had his fancy Italian Maseratis and Ferraris. Sean bolstered his tough guy image with elaborately outfitted 4-wheel drive hunting vehicles, and even Bella drove a souped-up little thing that cost twice as much as the new Valiant. Not one of them would have worn a digital wristwatch. Not Nana with her diamond Piaget, nor Sean with his macho gold Rolex. Things, Michael's smile turned down at the corners of his mouth. All they see are things, not people. It's the sickness of our country. There was a tap at the side window of the Valiant, and Michael started and looked around, expecting his contact. There was nobody there. He was startled. Then a small black hand with a pink palm came into view and diffidently tapped on the glass with one finger. Michael rolled down the window and stuck his head out. A black urchin grinned up at him. He could not have been more than 5 or 6 years of age. He was barefoot, and his singlet and shorts were ragged. Although his nostrils were crusted with white flakes of dried snot, his smile was radiant.
"Here, please, boss," he piped, and cupped his hands in a beggar's gesture. "Me hungry, please give 1 cent, boss."
Michael opened the door, and the child backed away uncertainly. Michael picked up his cardigan, which he had thrown on the seat beside him, and slipped it over the child's head. It hung down almost to his ankles, and the sleeves drooped a foot beyond his fingertips. Michael rolled them up for him and said in fluent Xhosa, "Where do you live, little one?" The boy was obviously flabbergasted, not only by this attention, but also to hear a white man speak Xhosa. 6 years before, Michael had realized that it was impossible to understand a man unless you spoke his language. He had been studying and practicing it since then. Not one white in 1,000 went to those lengths. All blacks were expected to learn either English or Afrikaans, otherwise they were virtually unemployable. Now Michael spoke both Xhosa and Zulu. These languages were closely related, and between them covered the vast majority of the black population of southern Africa.
"I live at Drake's farm in Xhosa,"